Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Meredith Lair examines the treatment of soldiers returning from the Vietnam War and looks at the accuracy of accounts of Vietnam veterans being spat upon by anti-war activists. This hour and 15-minute class is from a course called, quote, Legacies of the Vietnam War, and took place at George Mason University in Virginia.
So this, I think I asked you guys last time, how many of you have heard the story of that Vietnam veterans were spat upon when they came home from Vietnam? So virtually everybody, which is, that's a pretty powerful story. And that's a story when we're thinking like historians, we have to take a story like that seriously and think, what is going on here? We have an obligation to interrogate that story and ask, is this story supported by the historical record? And whether it is or it isn't, and I think the answer falls kind of somewhere in between, we still have to take seriously the power of the story and the way that the story gets recapitulated so that, you know, I think there's even a likelihood where people who didn't experience something can remember that they did. So how many of you have heard that story from somebody you know, where it was somebody you know that this happened to? So, oh, that's kind of interesting. So nobody has like a father, grandfather, uncle, family, friend. Nobody is in that who says that they were spat upon when they came home from Vietnam. That's kind of, what do you guys make of that? What do you think? Yeah. So where are we hearing these stories from? Yeah, that's a good question. Like if we're not hearing it from people we know directly, then where is the story coming to us? So if you didn't hear it from somebody you know, then where did you hear the story from? Yeah.
Tracy Kidder, in kind of the closing summary of My Detachment.
Okay.
That's one of the first things he says when he's coming home is he talks about the soldier that spat on at the airport.
Okay. A book that you read for this class was the first time that you had ever heard the idea that soldiers were spat on when they came home from Vietnam?
Not the first time.
Okay. But it is something that people address. Yeah. Austin.
Actually, my dad's friend. So
okay.
It was through the grapevine that I heard it.
Okay. Friend of a friend?
Yeah.
Or friend of your dad?
Yeah.
Okay. And it happened to him, or it was happened to somebody that he knew?
It happened to somebody that he knew in his family.
Okay.
So it was through the grapevine again. So I guess
right.
I guess word travels, something like that.
Okay. So other ways that you guys have heard the story? Yeah.
I think my textbook had a little excerpt from the John Kerry speech, the part where it says that we're being spat upon and all that.
Okay. Okay, so there are some little hints of that from contemporaneous documents of it maybe not spitting on, maybe spitting on, but a kind of hostility towards veterans because they represent, in some people's minds, the face of failure in Vietnam. And that could come from either the left or the right, but there was this feeling the veterans were coming home not to a warm, robust welcome, but a feeling that they were, you know, kind of the symbols of a failed set of policies. I'm not really hearing from you guys. Like, it's interesting that everybody's heard the story, and I'm assuming you heard the story like before I asked you, like, or before we took the class. So where did it come from? I don't know. I guess it's a rhetorical question. We'll just have to leave it as a rhetorical question, and we can talk about these accounts from Bob Green. One place that it comes up that you might be familiar with is Rambo. Right? Has anybody seen, I think it's the first one, First Blood. Has anybody seen First Blood? There's a few of you who have seen First Blood. And so there's a speech, I think, towards the end of the film where John Rambo kind of has a fit and he says, who are they to spit on me? And that's from like 1981 or 82. So movies are a place where the story kind of comes into the national conversation. But I think what we're starting to get a hold of here is that we've got a story, we're not really sure who the story belongs to, and it's so pervasive that we're not even sure where we heard it. So it kind of has that resonance like, well, that sounds kind of like a fact, but also like a myth, right? Things that you just know to be true. Nobody had to tell you the sky was blue. You can objectively kind of see that. We just know that that's a fact. But in this case, we've got a story. We just know it, but we're not really sure why we know it. Okay, well, let's talk about these pieces that I had you read. And I'm going to sit on this table, and I'm going to really hope the table doesn't break. Okay, that would be exciting. So just to give you a little background, because I didn't give you all the pieces. So Bob Green is a columnist. I think he's still writing for the Chicago Tribune. And he wrote a column in July of 1987, which was in the midst of a big kind of national conversation about the Vietnam War, in part because a lot of movies had come out in rapid succession in that time period. And he posited in this July column that I didn't have you read that he didn't think the story of veterans having been spat on was true. And so he basically opened it up to his readers to write in. He cast it as kind of a survey to say whether or not they thought it was true. And he ended up getting thousands of letters from people saying that they were veterans, and in some cases saying that it had happened to them, and in some cases saying it had not happened at all. And he then published a tiny, tiny sample of those in the column over the course of 4 days. So that's the piece that I had you read. And then he subsequently published a book, Homecoming, When the Soldiers Returned from Vietnam, that I had actually thought about requiring for this class, but it's out of print. So you could have read this book, but I couldn't guarantee that we could get enough copies, so I couldn't offer it. Why don't we just go over like kind of the points of the narrative as you guys have heard the story? Like, how does the story go? The story that you've heard, yeah.
I was in uniform.
Okay.
I was coming home from the airport. Mm-hmm. I was approached by guys in close to the similar age, would be 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
They said some obscenities and they spat on me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the general what I take away from these stories.
Right. And sometimes the story, maybe not the stories that Bob Green published, but some of the stories, it's a woman, which is an interesting detail because it helps to explain why there wasn't a fight. Because that's sort of one of the open-ended questions is why aren't there more fights? Isn't there something to which the police or journalists are calling attention to if this is happening as often as people think that it happened or report that it happened? Did you notice anything, having read these stories by these guys that wrote in to Bob Green, was there anything different about the stories that people wrote in compared to the story that you've heard? You guys are very shy today. Yeah, Charity.
The part about the fighting, I know one person said that they actually punched the person that spit on them in one of the articles.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard them fighting back. I always got the impression that they were kind of hurt from it, kind mm-hmm. of, slunk away, kind of sad about it. So
okay.
That was kind of surprising.
And does that seem more realistic to you or less realistic? More realistic? That, yeah, I mean, it was hard to reconcile with these stories that somehow, these are all young men, and there's questions at play about people's patriotism and about what it means to be a citizen and what it means to be a man. And spitting, as I mentioned last time, is really kind of the ultimate act of contempt. And so it's hard to imagine that a certain kind of person, like a combat veteran coming home directly from Vietnam, tired, it's an emotional time, that would sit lightly with them. So it's interesting, I think, that we get this greater degree of complexity. So other examples of how the stories you read today differed from the story you've heard? Yeah.
On the first article that you had us read by Green, he says, a lot of Vietnam veterans who are really high up refused to believe that anybody was spat on, and
mm-hmm.
I thought it would be something like the veterans would all be like, oh yeah, we were treated so horribly, but no, they're saying no, it never happened to anyone.
Yeah, and so so we get a sense that veterans are not a monolith, right? There are, and that makes sense, right? I mean, we're talking about even if we accept that the draft made the people fighting the Vietnam War not necessarily representative of that population that could have fought the war, there's still differences based on where people live and based on ages and based on levels of education, based on class, based on race and ethnicity, even based on gender, because there are women Vietnam veterans. And some of you read Linda Vannevanner's book. So from those people, because we can also pull in the conversation into the conversation from the books that you read for your papers, she has one of these stories. So how does her story go? Yeah.
Said how she comes home, she's in her fatigue, she's looking for a ride to the airport, and some guys come up, they're like, do you need a ride? Yeah, I could use one, but no, we don't give rides to, well, he says something offensive in that statement, and then he spits his tobacco dip on her, and they leave.
And that's just the first, like, what she describes is a kind of ordeal of trying to get a ride. She's trying to hitchhike to the airport. She's just been separated from the service, and now she's trying to go and catch the commercial flight that's going to take her home. And so what she reports is that she spent more than an hour, like multiple hours, trying to catch a ride and repeatedly being harassed or tormented by people picking her up. So on its face, it is a very disturbing story. Did it ring true to you when you read it?
Reaction to is I was hurt rather than I'm going to punch this guy in the face for doing this to me. She was ashamed that they were treating her like this when they weren't there in Vietnam.
But do you think somebody, I mean, where people have called attention to that particular story as problematic is that she claims she was out there trying to hitch a ride for hours and that this kept happening over and over as though there is just the most relentless tide of jerks, unimaginable, driving past this one stretch of California highway.
That's the one part I was wondering about.
Okay.
She was out there for a long time, and finally someone gave her a ride. Mm-hmm. But the reaction, I did believe.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with these stories is it we have to come at them, I think we come at them with two different personas. And one is our true self, and we tend to be empathetic, and we take people at face value. And that's absolutely how you should read things and deal with people, and I think try to find the humanity and in what they're saying and try to connect with it. And then we also have to put on our historian hats. And that, you don't completely divest yourself of your humanity when you become a historian, but you do use a more scrupulous set of tools. And you have to question whether things make sense. And you have to question the reasons why people might bend the truth in one direction or another. Basically, you have an obligation as a historian to question what you read, to be skeptical. And that can be really troubling because that can conflict with the messages that we get that we need to be respectful to veterans, that we should be respectful to people who are older than us. It's really hard to do. And I'm not suggesting that if you were ever personally talking to somebody that you say that you question, you know, the story they're telling you. But in terms of our scholarship, in terms of our research, our writing, that's where we have to try, well, how do we try to make sure that what a writer is telling us is actually a good, solid piece of historical evidence? What can we do to, if we were, say, writing a paper where we were using the stories that Bob Green tells or using the anecdote from Linda Vannevanter's book, what could we do to try to make that more useful to us? Yeah, Nicholas.
Corroboration.
Right.
See if there are other sources that mention the incident as well. If it's like a book in particular, find like the nearest note, look back in the notes, see where the author got from, and then go and pursue that source.
Right. So if you're reading a secondary source, which is a secondhand account, maybe by a scholar or a nonfiction writer, you would want to look at what that person's source of information was. If it's a memoir, it's problematic because this is something that just happened to one person, and it's interesting how in the stories there's often never anyone else around, right? It's not me and my friends, and here are their names, we're there, and this happened to us. That it's a sort of singular experience, which makes it very difficult to corroborate. So how else could we go about trying to corroborate one of these stories? What would we look for if we were trying to corroborate the story of a veteran being spat on coming home from the war? Yeah.
Try to find, like, pictures
pictures or video or something, like something that actually shows it happening rather than people talking about it.
Okay, it's a good suggestion, and that would be like, you know, that would be the perfect set of evidence. Aha, we have a picture of it. But, you know, that was a different time where there, you could walk out onto the tarmac of an airport, you know, that there was not the sort of security state that we have set up at present where there's cameras everywhere. So the idea that there would be surveillance cameras, that's anachronistic. And then even people's personal cameras were quite a different thing. I mean, you're talking about a purchase of several hundred dollars for a personal camera at a time when that's, a few months' rent. So very different than, you know, carrying your cell phone where everybody has a camera today, or even a $99 point-and-shoot camera around with you. So people just didn't have cameras. So nobody has actually provided photographic evidence of the spitting. There is evidence that people were spat on in the 60s, but the photographic evidence is of anti-war demonstrators who were spat on by the counter-demonstrators that I talked about last time. So there are photographs of that or of them being egged by counter-demonstrators, but we don't have photographic evidence of these incidents of spitting. So that's a problem. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it is a problem. So where else could we look if we wanted to find corroboration of these stories?
Individual came from?
Okay, that's a good idea. And I'm going to talk a little bit later about why that's a problem. But so the idea would be if you're a soldier and you're just back from the war, there would be other people with you. Except that coming back from Vietnam was a uniquely individualistic experience, and people weren't coming back as part of a unit. They might be hanging out in groups of friends, you know, or you meet somebody who's having the same experience, and you're like, hey, what are you doing for dinner? Let's, you know, going to San Francisco while we're here, and we'll, and before we part ways and go to our separate homes. But as far as being with your unit, that's not the reality of the homecoming for veterans. Yeah.
Even if it's not necessarily with your unit, there would still be other people on the same transport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you probably wouldn't know them. They might be from, you know, God knows what other,
mm-hmm.
you know, heaven forbid, if you're a Marine, you'd be stuck with a bunch of people from the Army
or
something like that. But there would still be other people on the plane.
So a historian could do, I mean, that would be a deep piece of research to try to find out when exactly somebody who claims that this happened to them, when exactly they came home, and try to figure out then who was on that transport, who was at this installation at that time, and try to build a story or kind of build corroboration by interviewing other people. Yeah.
Or like innocent bystanders that were maybe just there and saw someone get spit on, because sometimes they're the most trustworthy source since it's not happening to them.
Right.
They're actually like, oh wow, someone's getting spit on in a uniform. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if that's easily found, but that would be a good source.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I don't know if it was a choice of Bob Green just to publish this from the veterans themselves, but a lot of them report this happening in a public space. And I think the one guy who chased down his attackers, he said people applauded him. And so there were other people there. And so that would certainly, if there were people who were recalling having witnessed this, that would lend credence to it. But I think we have to, whether it's an eyewitness account or it's the account of the person to whom it happened, there's a difference between a contemporaneous account, somebody saying this happened to me yesterday, and this happening to me 20 years ago, right? So for us as historians, a story has more credibility if you can find contemporaneous evidence of it. So something that was in the newspaper at the time, or something that was recorded in a police report at the time, or something that was published in a memoir close to when the incident happened. That would be a more compelling piece of evidence than people kind of reflecting back on it, because as we established at the top, this is a story we've all heard and ostensibly know to be true, and yet nobody in this room could actually say, I was told this by somebody. It's just something that kind of comes to us like the air we breathe. So, well, what's your reaction to the issue? Do you think Do you think that veterans were spat on in the Vietnam War? Forgot to advance my slide. There we go.
I think it seems highly unlikely that with so many different people claiming they were spat on, that not one of them wasn't. Okay. But at the same token, I think that it is highly suspicious that almost every story follows the same timeline. So I think you have to be skeptical, but I don't think you could ever say that no, nobody was ever spat on.
Okay. Okay. So it's all about kind of couching it with appropriate qualifying language. You're talking exactly like a historian, where we're very hard to pin down. Other thoughts on it? Yeah.
Mostly the sheer number of responses that Green got from his question to confirm or deny this. That seems pretty much as overwhelming evidence. I don't think that many people can have that same experience. That's just too much evidence to overlook.
Okay.
I think it happened. It definitely happened.
Okay. Yeah.
I would say also agree with him. It definitely happened, but like Tracy Kidder said, like, I don't think it happened to the extent that it's blown up to be in the media, because mm-hmm. I think there would have been like more security at the airports and stuff like that, like a lot of different airports, which there wasn't. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't have happened too much, mm-hmm. you know.
Or not quite in the way that people said, like where you're literally stepping off the plane and there's a bunch of hippies on the tarmac. That doesn't sound like any Army base or Air Force base I've ever been to where they just let the hippies out on the tarmac, you know? It sort of defies, like, really? Like, gosh, maybe that explains why we didn't do so well in the war, is like we just let hippies go wherever they want. No, that's not how it works. So there are some details in there that we have to be skeptical of. And Tracy Kidder, a lot of you read Tracy Kidder's memoir, right? I mean, he's very open about even himself having led people to believe that he experienced things in Vietnam that didn't actually happen to him. And so he, I think, in this very honest and powerful way, says there is an incentive to cast yourself as a victim. And he allowed it to happen. He relates this anecdote. He said it wasn't a lie, it was just a freighted suggestion, where he had been a jerk at a party and kind of by way of explaining away his behavior, he said he was, I guess, had been drinking, and he says to his friend, "Did you ever kill anybody?" And his friend says, "No, did you?" And Tracy Kidder then just kind of lets the silence make the suggestion that, yes, he says something like, "I don't want to talk about it," right? And allows that to answer the question for his friend. Totally not true. Jenny, what did you want to say?
Just with everything with Tracy Kidder, it's just, he's just super honest. It's not even like he's honest. He's just almost like, "I'm going to tell you this exactly how it should be." And I love that throughout the book, he's always like, "I'm not a lifer. You know, yeah, these guys are, you know, they're in it, they're doing this for life, but me, this isn't my job. I'm in it until I get out." And it's just, I feel like a lot of veterans were probably that way, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't want to be portrayed that way just because they want to seem like, "Oh, you know, I did this selflessly and I'm doing all this stuff." But just what I appreciated about Tracy Kidder is that, you know, he said, you know, I just, like when he signed up, he did it really because he had nothing better to do. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's pretty amazing to just have somebody so honest.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable even. And it's kind of a reminder of, like, we make a lot of decisions in our lives that are just, I don't know, life is actually kind of boring most of the time, you know? And then when we look back on it, we sort of remember all the boring stuff about, you know, putting your pants on one leg at a time and, you know, how much time you wasted, you know, playing one of those stupid games on Facebook. And, you know, we just cut out all of the tedious minutiae that casts ourselves unfavorably. And then what we remember is a much more colorful life. And I think if people write a memoir and they cut out all the kind of drudgery in between the exciting stuff, that can be a very misleading memoir. And Tracy Kidder has very artfully done the opposite, where he writes this memoir that's about this sort of connective tissue between these important things. And it's really brutally honest. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the part when he was talking about when he talked about that people supposedly being spat on, and he kind of said that he was mostly ignored. He wished he would have actually gotten spat on because he was ignored. No mm-hmm. one noticed his uniform. No one noticed him coming back from Vietnam. And like she said, I do agree that some vets may have had that actual experience than actually being harassed, or they actually mm-hmm. wanted to be noticed for what they had done.
Right.
And that seems more logical, or at least plausible to me, than everyone just getting harassed and spit on and, mm-hmm. you know, just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think we would often say that the opposite of love is hate. But anybody who's ever been in a failed relationship knows that the opposite of love is indifference, right? And so for these veterans coming back and maybe wanting some acknowledgement, the most painful thing is not necessarily being rejected or being harassed or being spat on, but that they were simply ignored. And I'm going to talk later in the lecture, probably not till Wednesday, but that there are contemporaneous accounts of that, of people writing in newspapers and interviewing veterans where they're saying they feel this pressure to put the uniform away, to slip back into civilian life unnoticed, and to kind of pretend that it had never happened, which is really hard and asking an awful lot of somebody who's had a very formative, maybe violent, dangerous experience for a year, that you would just feel this social pressure to pretend that it didn't happen. Yeah. What did you want? You had your hand up.
I just wanted to address Tracy Kidder's exact quote. He says, a soldier returns home and at the airport is spat upon. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a general just like overview of the idea of that happening. Mm-hmm. And he did wish to get spat upon when he was walking around. I think, I can't remember the adversity, but he was walking around with another officer. And he says something to the extent of like, what if we had been spat upon? Mm-hmm. Like how would we react to that? And yeah, he does kind of almost wish that happens to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think it's also interesting if you think about it, because Vietnam was probably like the first war that they were coming back not on like a big old ship full of soldiers who could all unwind together. Mm-hmm. It was an individual experience where you really didn't have that unwinding process with a bunch of guys who were in the same situation.
Right.
So maybe that made it that much more compelling to have that experience or to have some experience.
Right, to have something noteworthy about it, because I think that's just the most, it just makes me sad to think about somebody coming home, and I'm going to talk to you in a minute about how badly people wanted that day to come, and then for that day to come, and nobody else cares. You know, all these people at the airport are just, you know, it's just another day for them. And I've read memoirs of soldiers for whom they've had kind of lousy families, and it was just another day for their families. I think for most people, though, it was, you know, a momentous experience. I mean, it's a story that from my own dad's experience, I've heard that story about when he came home and my mother and the noises she made and how excited she was to see him. And I think people have that in a very intimate, individual way with their family, but there's nothing socially like broader going on. There's not a more generalized outpouring of recognition from the public. I want to make a note about Bob Green's columns versus the book, because there is kind of a difference between them that I hadn't really noticed because I read them at two different times, but then I was reading another book that had a chapter on the spitting. It's a book called War Stories, kind of a problematic book. I mean, it's interesting. It's by a Vietnam veteran who kind of takes some of the myths of the Vietnam War and interrogates them, and he really believes firmly that the spitting either never happened or didn't happen to the extent that people claim that it did. But it's problematic for our purposes as a work of history because he often is substituting his own recollections as a Vietnam veteran for any kind of corroborating research. But he drew my attention to the fact that there is a kind of big difference between what Bob Green published in the newspaper. And you can see on the screen that it's divided into kind of four interpretations. Yes, veterans were spat on. The memories are vivid. No, they were not spat on. They recall acts of kindness. Or they were not spat upon, but hounded and hurt. The chapters in his book, he publishes a couple hundred letters, and there's an entire chapter of people saying this did not happen. And so a much more forceful, in the book, a more forceful statement from veterans saying we don't think this actually happened. We think that this is a particular kind of person trying to draw attention to themselves who's manufacturing these stories. And so these were veterans not just saying, well, we weren't spat upon, we had nice things, or not just saying we weren't spat upon, but people actually saying, we don't think this happened to anyone else either. So if you do read the book, it's interesting to kind of compare that. I think the articles themselves and the attention that it got when this was published in the Chicago Tribune back in the late 80s really helped to solidify the story in the public imagination. So I think Bob Green played his own role. He was just trying to draw attention and ask the question. I think he actually affirmatively took steps to solidify what is, in the end, a very troubling narrative. So I don't know that I'm necessarily going to be able to clarify this definitively for you guys. But with this really terrible text-heavy slide, I guess I'll kind of talk you through it. So I don't know that you need to write all that down, but I guess I can't stop you. So I just kind of laid it out, in two columns. On the one hand, the idea that it's a myth, and on the other hand, the idea that this is a legitimate memory that belongs to people for whom it happened. So on the one side, on the myth side, there's a sociologist named Jerry Lemke who published a book called The Spitting Image. I probably, in fairness, should have brought a copy of that book today, but I didn't. So it's called The Spitting Image. And he claims in that book that there are no contemporaneous accounts of spitting, meaning no accounts from the 60s or 70s, and that the accounts start appearing in the newspapers in the 1980s. And he goes on to pull apart some of the details that you've talked about. The idea that, would hippies, these guys who are allegedly afraid to fight, I mean, that's really a problematic stereotype, but would they really be bold enough to confront an actual war veteran in person in this way? Another problematic detail is that the stories so often involve women doing the spitting, and Lemke argues that that's a kind of a detail of convenience to explain why there wouldn't be more violence directed at the spitters. It's because they're women. But he says, women don't spit. So some of you are laughing. That's a very problematic view of gender, right? That there's somehow things that women do that men don't, and vice versa. That somehow women just don't spit, that it's unseemly, I guess. And then I think the most compelling problematic detail is that protesters were not allowed on U.S. bases. So we have to take as suspect any story that reports that soldiers are stepping off the plane from Vietnam and encountering demonstrators on the tarmac. And on another sort of element on the myth column is this idea that there is a sameness to the stories. And that tends to cast it as a myth or an urban legend, this thing that happened to a friend of a friend of a friend, and with only some small variations in detail, unfolds in the same way every time. And then another problematic detail, again drawing from Lemke's book, is that the anti-war movement was not inherently hostile to veterans. And there's plenty of evidence on that side that there's, as we talked about, a large presence of veterans within the anti-war movement, and a lot of the rhetoric of the anti-war movement was about bringing the soldiers home, was an anti-war protesters essentially casting themselves as the rescuers of soldiers who were being held in Vietnam against their will, and trying to end the war in order to bring those people home. So these are all factors that I think call into question the reality of the story. On the memory side, we have the fact that veterans recall this having happened to them, that we have a large number of people who say, this was my lived experience. And it's very hard to prove that something didn't happen. It's hard to, there's really, you can try to build a case of corroboration around that, but the way the stories are told, these are people who are alone. They were in places, often airports or communities where they weren't known by other people. And, it is possible that something could happen to them that would not, leave a trace other than their own memory. the reason that I had you guys read the sort of back and forth from 2007 between the editor of Slate.com and the Volokh conspiracy is that people have started to challenge the idea that there were no contemporaneous accounts of the spinning. And so from the efforts of, I can't remember the guy's name, writing, does anybody remember, for the Volokh conspiracy? You're close, but I can't remember. Anyway, they started, basically the readers of that particular blog started to root around in the dark corners of the internet and started to find contemporaneous accounts and drew attention to, I think, a very problematic research issue with Jerry Lemke's book, and that's that Lemke reported that reports of spitting on veterans started to appear in the early 1980s. Do you remember what the Volokh conspiracy post said about this? What's the problem with that, when contemporaneous accounts start appearing in the early 1980s? Yeah.
It said something about newspapers being online available for research at that time. They weren't available until 1980, so they didn't have the prior years.
Right, and so you guys are gonna encounter this, most of you are history majors, when you have to do your research papers in History 300 or 499, that it can be very frustrating if you're dealing with 20th century topics that there is a dearth of material, like there's a sort of gap where there's like, well, there's great 19th century collections, but a lot of contemporary newspapers aren't digitized prior to 1980. Like there's a kind of gap there between the earlier section, the historical section, and when they started digitizing them. It's getting better. Lemke wrote his book in the early 90s, so it's a different situation. We're 20 years on, and more papers are digitized further and further back, and it's from that kind of research that a few contemporaneous accounts have emerged, including video. Do you remember this, the video? There's a video clip of one guy from CBS News. Did anybody watch it? No? Okay. You guys are all staring at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. But it's on there. I bounced around, like there were a lot of embedded links in those pieces, and I guess maybe because I'm a nerd and I love this stuff, I checked all of them out. And somewhere in there is actually a CBS, I think it's CBS News, interview with a veteran, and he makes this very just kind of haphazard, offhand remark about he was in an airport in his uniform and these two guys spat on him. And I mean, and that's all he says. And he just says, you know, kind of in this tone of like, isn't that crazy? And then he goes on to talk about other things. And he has been tracked down and he stands by his story. And it has a kind of very philosophical take on it. But that's a compelling piece of evidence from 1970 that tells us that maybe this didn't happen as often as people claim, but it did seem to happen. Obviously, as far as women do spit, right? Women are capable of behaving in very bad ways. Anyone who's been wasted in a bar, well, you don't have to be wasted in a bar, you just have to be in a bar where people are wasted. And we have plenty of evidence of that in people's Facebook pictures, right? That women can be disgusting. And so I think that is a very problematic way of attacking the problem, say that it just didn't happen because women aren't capable of it. As far as the details of the story, the spitting or other forms of harassment could happen anywhere. I think people connect it to this experience of walking off the plane or just having arrived home from Vietnam. But the accounts, both in Bob Green's column, in the book, and then the contemporaneous accounts that have come up elsewhere, they talk not necessarily about people having this happen to them right when they get off the plane, but it's something that happens to them maybe when they start school and somebody finds out they're a veteran, or that they're just walking down the street on a Friday night and somebody knows that they're a veteran, or maybe they're still in uniform, and that happens. And there was harassment. There are other documented cases of harassment. I've heard stories of harassment from my own mother. I'm not going to share them today, but she was a waiting wife with a husband in Vietnam, and she felt very besieged by the kind of rancorous tone of the anti-war movement. And there are newspaper accounts of the families of people serving in Vietnam being harassed by telephone or in person. So we have contemporaneous accounts of other kinds of harassment that I think lends credence to the idea that all right, something is going on here that's really troubling. And so I guess that's to the last point there, that some anti-war protesters were jerks or worse. Since this is a PG class, I won't use the word that I would probably normally use. But, you know, just being anti-war and being for peace doesn't mean you're not just a complete jerk. And so I think we have to distinguish between people who have a particular opinion and are exercising that in a very inappropriate and hurtful way from the movement as a whole, that there was no directed campaign, no tactical effort on the part of anti-war organizations to direct harassment at veterans. Quite the opposite, in fact. They recognized the value of having veterans marching with them, or having veterans speak against the war using their credibility to argue against it. So I think the anti-war movement, people who were really engaged and part of organizations, they recognized the value of veterans to their movement and actively worked, as we'll see on Wednesday, actively worked to try to bring veterans into that process. So antagonizing veterans, you know, on the street is going to run counter to their goals. Okay, let's talk about why it matters. Hopefully you guys think that it matters. I have, I guess, three suggestions for why it matters, whether or not veterans were spat upon. One is that it affects the way we think about the Vietnam anti-war movement. It essentially affects the credibility of the anti-war movement. If we look back on the anti-war movement and say it was inhabited by people who were foul-mouthed and vulgar and rude and cruel, that does not reflect well on their cause. And so for people who want to undermine the legitimacy of the Vietnam anti-war movement in the historical narrative of the war, casting anti-war demonstrators as people who harassed veterans is a good way of doing that. The photograph, incidentally, is of an anti-war demonstration sponsored by Vietnam veterans on the steps of the US Capitol. So just that photograph, you know, calls into question this issue of whether or not the anti-war movement was hostile to veterans, because the anti-war movement was in part composed of veterans. So one problem with the spitting story is that a way that it affects how we think of the anti-war movement. The thing is, the Vietnam War it's not the only American war with a robust anti-war movement. In fact, every American war has had some kind of anti-war movement, including World War II. It's just that in World War II, it was infinitesimally small. So I like to think of Hitler as the person who ruined pacifism for everyone. So we tend to look back at World War II and say, oh, that's the norm, right? That everybody supports the war and there's no anti-war movement. But in fact, World War II historically is the anomaly. That's the aberration. And so Vietnam has a particularly robust anti-war movement, and for that, it makes it, I think, more consistent with other American wars. But because we have this kind of warped way of thinking that Vietnam is somehow unique for having had an anti-war movement, that then colors how we think about subsequent anti-war movements. And so the other reason why we should be concerned about whether or not veterans were spat upon is that when the Vietnam anti-war movement is delegitimized by those kinds of stories, that works in the public's imagination to undermine the credibility of subsequent anti-war movements. So affecting the credibility of the Vietnam anti-war movement affects the credibility of other movements since Vietnam. And this image, I thought, kind of tells that story very well. Please note that it is photoshopped, okay? It is a fake image. It was a real demonstration. The women are real. Code Pink is a real anti-war organization that has protested very strenuously against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know what their original banner said, but a conservative blog photoshopped in the text, "We support the murder of American troops," right? And so this is casting contemporary anti-war demonstrators as being hostile to the troops. And that's, you know, almost, especially around 2005, 2006, or up from 2003 to that point, that was one of the worst things that you could say to somebody, was that they didn't support the troops. I mean, it's just akin to saying you're the lowest form of scum. Like, who doesn't support the troops? And in this case, saying that Code Pink actively endorses the murder of American troops. So it's a very harsh assessment of anti-war activism. And I think that undermining the legitimacy of the Vietnam movement makes it easier to undermine the legitimacy of these subsequent movements, to cast these people as hateful, to cast them as outcasts, to cast them as people who don't work, or people who are indifferent to the sufferings of soldiers. So I think these stories are inherently connected, and that's one of the points of the class, is to think about how the stories we tell about the Vietnam War impact our understanding of conflict and you know, the course of the nation in the present. And then I think the stories about the spitting tend to obscure the reality of what happened to Vietnam veterans when they came home. And there were certainly shortcomings associated with that experience, where veterans did not get the care and at times the respect that they were due. The question is that the anti-war movement's fault? That's what the spitting story suggests, that anti-war demonstrators are the ones who made these guys feel so unwelcome and unappreciated. Or does the blame for that lie elsewhere? And so that's one of the questions that I'm going to try to answer through the lecture. So let me pause there and see if you have questions about anything at this point. Yeah, Cody.
Why should the debate over spitting be linked to the military action during the very notorious presidencies?
Can you say the first part of that again?
The debate over spitting.
The debate, okay.
When that started in the 80s, all of that, can that be linked to the military action during the presidencies at the time?
Well, I think the problem is we're not really sure if the debate over it started in the 80s or if there was a kind of national conversation for which we don't have evidence yet of it taking place earlier. I think absolutely that you can, let's say you take a text like Rambo, it's a really interesting text. I mean, a lot of these pop culture films are, we can interpret them as part of a dialogue about foreign policy in the 80s. So I think there is a connection there. Jerry Lemke wrote his book in the early, it was around the time of the first Persian Gulf War, like 90, 91. And he was writing because there was the proliferation of yellow ribbons really began in the Persian Gulf War. You guys are familiar with yellow ribbons, right? Probably have one on your car. Everybody had one on their car for a while. Although you guys were so little, maybe you didn't have cars when the war started, this last war. But that there was a very overt effort to support the troops in the first Persian Gulf War. And that ethic has continued through our present wars. But something really dramatically changed with the first Persian Gulf War. And it was very much a reaction to the perception that veterans had been spat on. So I think that the way that the story of the spitting enters the discourse, whether it really entered the discourse in the 80s, I think I'm willing to leave that as an open question. It certainly intensified, and Bob Green's columns were evidence of that. This about the discourse about how should we treat veterans and whether they were spat on, and if they were spat on, what are we going to do about it? And the answer that a lot of people embraced was the way that we should repay Vietnam veterans is to treat subsequent veterans better. And hence then the yellow ribbons just started rolling off the assembly line. And they, you know, originally were actually ribbons. In the first Persian Gulf War, people would tie yellow ribbons around trees and stuff. And then the yellow magnets that sort of took over. For the present wars. So, yeah, I don't have I don't know that I've answered your question. I mean, because I'm still trying to wrestle with this myself, and it's definitely an issue that is deserving of further research. So, other questions? Yeah.
If the stories of veterans being spat upon weren't true, what would be the point of so many people saying that they were?
I'm going to open that up to the class. What do you guys think? And especially some of you have read Tracy Kidder's book, he offers an explanation for that. Any idea why? What did people get out of saying that they had been spat on?
Well, they get a sense of being victimized. mm-hmm. which could, you know, obtain you know, a certain amount of sympathy, mm-hmm. Which then can grant a certain amount of purpose.
Okay.
But I think having that victimization kind of lends them, you know, support in a way because, you know, they can kind of have people rally around them.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of gives them more credibility.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there is a cachet surrounding being a veteran, period, okay? It hasn't always been that way. In fact, that's something that starts to change in the 80s, or at least as far as being a Vietnam veteran. In fact, I pulled a lot of articles in preparation for this class about people were writing about it in the late 80s about a kind of memory boom for veterans, and they called it Vietnam chic, how suddenly, all of a sudden, it was cool or desirable or socially advantageous to be a Vietnam veteran as of the mid to late 80s when it had been a complete liability to be a Vietnam veteran in the 1970s. So there's a kind of social cachet around it. The issue of victimization is a complicated one. And I think Vietnam veterans would reject the idea that they were casting themselves as victims, but if we do look at sort of just the story, not at any particular person's experience, then the story is that they have been victimized by the anti-war movement, that they were humiliated, that they were rejected. And that serves, I think, two purposes. One, it kind of solidifies the idea that there is a debt to be owed, a debt to be paid by society. And two, it delegitimizes anti-war activism in general. What did you want? Did you want to add? No? Okay, but it's a really good question. And I'm glad that you, do you feel like I answered it? I mean, it's a hard question, right? And it's a question I'd like to know the answer to as well, because, I mean, people claim regarding the Vietnam War to have experienced all kinds of unheroic things or to have done things that they didn't do that are actually war crimes. And so we have to ask the question, like, why would somebody claim that they murdered and raped a Vietnamese villager when they didn't do that? And there's evidence of people having, claimed that they did these things. So, like I said, I think the answers to a lot of these questions have yet to be really scrupulously researched. Okay, so I want to talk in our remaining time about some of the particulars of the homecoming, like the actual getting, you know, going home and so forth. And I think that this, you know, will help to inform how you read the story of the spitting. Right? It's not designed to undermine it. It's not designed to reinforce it. It's just, I think, here's information you need to know in order to appreciate what these stories mean and how they resonate as true or not true. So the first thing I want to talk about is the one-year tour of duty in Vietnam, which is something that's new. Basically, that soldiers would serve 1 year. The Marines served 13 months, and I think I misspoke in a previous class and said that they served 9 months. That's in the present conflict. In Vietnam, the Marines served 13 months. So anybody who served in Vietnam had 1 year or 13 months at the outside. They could elect to extend that, but there was a limit placed on it. And the decision-making there was done for two reasons. First, the tour of duty was kept to 1 year as opposed to being open-ended. In order to maintain soldier morale. So in World War II, we'll use that as our kind of classic example, soldiers served for the duration of the conflict. And that what that meant is that you were going to be in the army, and they can do with what, or in the military, and they can do with you what they want until you are killed or so grievously wounded you're of no use to them anymore, or until the conflict is over. And so when people would go off to war, they are literally giving their lives up to this institution and hoping for the best, because that's the only way you're ever going home, is in a body bag, that you're horribly wounded, or the war is over. So I think your concept of time is going to be altered by that. The feeling in the Vietnam era was that there wasn't robust enough public support to ask soldiers to do that. Right, that soldiers themselves, it would affect their morale, and that the public would not have it. And so out of concern for soldier morale, out of concern for public support for the war, the decision was made to limit these tours of duty to 1 year or 13 months. So that changes kind of the idea of time for a soldier, because it becomes all about getting through your year. It's not necessarily about achieving the mission. It's not about winning the war. It's about getting through the year. And I want you to be thinking about this in light of what we talked about previously, that there are a lot of people, somewhere between a third and two-thirds, who serve in Vietnam who are not there because they genuinely believe in the cause or because they want to go to war, because they want to have a career in the military. They're there because they were subject to the draft, or they were kind of coerced out of fear of the draft into enlisting. So, a year seems manageable, right? But people then kind of fixate on that. Let me see if there's... So I want to just mention something known as the combat cycle. This is from research by a sociologist named Charles Moskos and others that have looked at how then the one-year tour of duty affects combat effectiveness. And what they found was that there's a sort of cycle to it, where we're talking here about combat troops, and remember, not even by a long shot are a majority of American soldiers combat troops. But at least for combat troops, they get to Vietnam and they're next to useless because they're so new and so green, they don't know what's going on, and they're actually a liability to their fellow soldiers. So so when they're green, they're ineffective. Then there's a kind of ideal period from maybe the 6th to 9th month where they're old soldiers, they're battle-hardened, they're experienced, they know what they're doing, they have a high esprit de corps, and they are very, very effective. And then what happens between months 9 and 12 is they become less effective again because they're afraid. If we borrow a phrase from the John Kerry piece you had to read, nobody wants to be the last guy to die for a mistake. And certainly nobody wants to die on their last day in Vietnam. And there were a handful of people for whom that happened, where they, I mean, I guess everybody died on their last day in Vietnam. It was their last day anywhere. But there were people who died when they had one day left, or they had 1 week left. So people would get really cautious when they would have just a few weeks left on their tour, because everybody is obsessed with their DROS. The DROS is the date, I always get this part mixed up, it's the date of estimated return from overseas, date of estimated return from overseas, and basically it's your day to go home. And pretty much every Vietnam veteran I have ever talked to can to this day remember what their DROS was, because that is the date that you fixate on for a year. I have met some people who could not remember what their DROS was, and it made me strongly think they weren't actually Vietnam veterans. So it's an interesting way of assessing that issue, because it was something that people were so keenly aware of. So let me give you a couple of examples of this. These are DROS calendars. I pulled these images off the web. We have the one on the top left, somebody who had a desk job in Vietnam, and this is their little day planner. And on July 11th, 1971, that was the day he was going home, right? And he had saved this, took a picture of it, put it on the internet. But this is something of great meaning to them. This one I intentionally made kind of small because it's a naked lady. This was a very common DROS calendar or short-timer calendar, where these two, they're kind of like coloring books, and they were published in Army publications, like in newsletters for the troops. It was a different time. And basically, the naked lady is covered in little squares. Her body is in little squares, and you would color them in as the days passed, like 1 to 365. You would count down from 365. And so so the last of them, it's the breasts, 3, 2, and then 1. And this person has left the 1. Uncolored, so I apologize if I offended you, but there's actually no shortage of these on the internet because these were ubiquitous in Vietnam. And it just shows like the sort of sense of longing. This is a short-timer's calendar, how short I am. And the image is like there's little signs, one way going camp and the other way is mom's mess hall, like that way is home. And I think it's very sweet that this is, somebody has done a really good job of coloring this in with many, many different colored crayons. And the joke about being a short timer was, you know, always he's so short, you know, insert lame punchline here. And so this person is so short, you know, it's just a pair of combat boots with a helmet, right? Because they're short. They just have a little bit of time left on their tour. And so I talk about this phenomenon in my book, and I use the phrase that basically GIs lived in a state of collective yet individualized longing. Because everybody has this experience of wanting to go home and knowing when they're going to go home, but the experience is totally individualized because everybody's DROS is different. So everybody's arriving there as individuals, everybody's being sent home as individuals. It's not that you are all as a unit imagining that you're going to go home, you and your platoon, or you and your company, or you and your battalion. That was rarely the case when entire units would be cycled back to the United States. For most people, they went in as individuals, they came out as individuals, and they spent that year, you know, fixating on that, what that day would be for them. And so I think you can imagine that this kind of decision, this strategic decision to create one-year tours of duty and to cycle people in and out, as opposed to calling up the guard or calling up the reserves or putting the nation on a more robust war footing. It was all done for mostly political reasons, but had profound consequences for the soldiers who actually had to go through this. And I think it was a very lonely, isolating, and alienating experience, because it's really jarring, this process of going home. So I just want to draw your attention to a couple of features. I'm always interested in complicating the idea that Vietnam was solely a war dominated by a combat experience. And so these are, I think they're actually Air Force personnel, but these are military personnel on the tarmac in South Vietnam who are getting ready to get on the Freedom Bird, as it was known, to go home. And you notice they've got their suitcases with them, right? But there was also something known as hold baggage. And it's another thing that I did some research into that's really interesting in terms of what did soldiers bring home from Vietnam. And there was no requirement. You could just bring home as little as you wanted. But the hold baggage process provided a very cheap way to send whatever you had acquired in Vietnam home at taxpayers' expense. And it was insured, and 95% of the time it worked correctly. And you could have stuff crated up and sent home. And the policies dictated you were allowed to bring X number of pounds into Vietnam, depending on your rank, and you were allowed to bring X number of pounds out of Vietnam, depending on your rank. And embedded in the policies was the assumption that you would double your personal property while in Vietnam, that you would, you know, potentially arrive with 100 pounds of baggage in Vietnam. But the policy, and they did this because of the demand, they said, you know, if you're X rank, you can go home with 200 pounds. It went up to like 800 or 1,000 pounds for generals. So I just want to draw your attention that this is not everything these guys are sending home, because people are shopping in Vietnam. They're buying souvenirs. They're buying electronics at the PX at, you know, dramatically reduced rates, and all of that stuff is relatively cheap for them to send home. So it's an interesting way of thinking about Vietnam that it's certainly not a substitute for losing a life of your year, but or life of your year, a life, excuse me, a year of your life to the state. But it is, the military put all of this in place to try to use consumer goods and material possessions to kind of boost the morale of troops. So this is the time then when you start going home. And the Freedom Bird was the term of art for the plane that would take you home. And these were commercial airliners that were contracted by the military to take the troops home. And I just, you know, I think the term Freedom Bird is really instructive, because what it does is cast life back in the world or back in the United States as freedom. And life in Vietnam is unfreedom. Right, that it is some kind of penalty, that you're jailed by the institution of the military. And for a lot of guys, especially those who weren't dealing with combat, the most frustrating thing that they had to deal with was the fact that their freedom was curtailed while they were in the military. So the plane that takes you home is the bird that delivers you from your oppression. And again, this is all an individualized experience. So you are getting your orders, you are finding your transportation, you know, it is you by yourself going from your home unit to these the central depots, usually at Tansanaert Air Base outside of Saigon. And so you're on a plane with people you've never met before, right? And maybe you make fast friends. I would imagine that you probably would be a bonding experience, but these aren't necessarily guys who know each other. And so I think at a time of you know, kind of fraught emotion, people are going through that by themselves. As far as coming home, you know, it's different. There are exceptions, but the most common experience was to fly by commercial airliner. Again, you're not on the plane with civilians because they've been contracted by the military, but it's not a military kind of plane. And they would have civilian stewardesses and cabin crews that were you know, providing the drinks and so forth. And they would arrive at Travis Air Force Base in Northern California. And then the military would put them on buses to take them to Oakland, if they were in the Army, to Oakland Army Base for out-processing. And for a lot of guys who had been drafted into the military, coming home meant that they were out of the Army as well. Or in some cases, maybe they would extend their tour in Vietnam so that they wouldn't owe the Army any time when they got out. But so for a lot of people, this experience of out-processing also involves separation from the service, where they are no longer in the military. They have fulfilled their obligation. For some, they did still owe time where they could, you know, would have to serve for a period of weeks or even months on a stateside army base or potentially, you know, be sent overseas. And of course, if you were a career soldier, this would be a different kind of experience. But for a lot of guys, this was the end of their military experience when they got to Oakland. And you know, as far as what the out-processing was, it was a pretty quick experience where the paperwork and everything maybe took a day or two. So you were housed in a kind of temporary barracks. There was a cursory physical. There was a lot of signing of forms. You were issued a new Class A dress uniform, and those would be the clothes that you would wear. If you didn't own any civilian clothes, that would be what you would wear home. So you know, as we think about the details of the various spitting stories, you know, anybody who says that they're like in jungle fatigues or they're in their clothes from Vietnam, that's a problematic version of the story because all of that is usually discarded and people were very proud to put on these Class A dress uniforms. And then from Northern California, Oakland, San Francisco, they would basically take a commercial flight back to wherever they were from. And so getting from Oakland Army Base, the military provided buses. So that's sort of a problematic detail of, say, Linda Vantevanter's story is why is she hitchhiking from Oakland to the airport when there is a bus that she could take? Yeah.
There was a transit strike, I think.
Okay, so she does account for that?
Yeah, the bus took her halfway, and then okay. The guy kind of like, ha-ha, you know, bye, and just dropped her off in the middle of nowhere. So.
That would be an interesting thing to look into. That would be, I mean, that's a corroborating detail that a historian could track down if we wanted to do that with that book. Okay, so, you know, depending on how long your out-processing experience took, you could maybe, like, go into San Francisco for a night on the town and so forth. So a lot of these stories take place in San Francisco, which is a hotbed of anti-war activity and chock full of hippies. And so, you know, that would account for why there are so many soldiers in uniforms on the streets of San Francisco. But it wasn't required, and it wasn't something that everybody did. And, you know, you're really, really tired. You know, you've just flown. Usually it's a couple of legs. Like, it's not a direct flight from Vietnam. Often there's a stopover somewhere in the Pacific. And, you know, so I can't speak to how common it was that soldiers would actually go into San Francisco, but it certainly... It wasn't everybody who chose to do that. I think most people were just fixated on going home, on catching that final flight, commercial flight, to get home. This photo, incidentally, is from 1970 or 71, and that's a GI who has gotten off the plane, and this is, you know, this is taken at Travis Air Force Base, and that's kind of what there was. I mean, it's sort of grim. Maybe it would be a little better if it was in color. I imagine the USA, at least, is red, white, and blue. But it's not an especially cheerful or affirming, you know, kind of welcome back to American soil. So there's this question of whether or not GIs coming back from Vietnam would encounter demonstrators. So this is an actual photo from outside of Travis Air Force Base. And here's a guy holding a sign for all of the people going in and out of the base to see. Nazis were executed for bombing dikes, kind of drawing a comparison between the Nuremberg war crimes trials and accusations of American, cruelty, I guess, with its use of air power in Vietnam. Kind of making an anti-war point by drawing an analogy to how we punished similar behavior after World War II. He's just standing there. He's not on the tarmac. He's not anywhere near the airfield. But as far as whether someone was likely to encounter demonstrations at the airport after their separation from service, yeah, that's possible. Could it happen if you were on leave in San Francisco? Absolutely. That is a possible scenario. Could it happen outside Travis Air Force Base or Oakland Army Base? Yeah, we have a photo of that. This is one guy. People recall seeing groups of people, and certainly anti-war demonstrators did launch demonstrations outside of these facilities, outside of recruitment depots and so forth, because they wanted to take their case directly to the military or even to the soldiers who had served in Vietnam. So absolutely, you could encounter demonstrators in these places. But on the tarmac, after getting off a plane from Vietnam, that's a very unlikely scenario. But it's interesting how the stories, one of whom I came across, it was somebody that I know through my family, and then we found his blog, and he reports this great detail about wounded soldiers being taken off a plane and having to walk within feet of anti-war demonstrators, and that the MPs were there wearing ponchos that they would essentially, kind of spread their wings like this to protect these wounded soldiers from a barrage of spit and eggs and garbage, right? So this imagines a proximity between a plane on a tarmac and anti-war demonstrators armed with garbage and everything else, of just a space of a few feet, right? Incredibly detailed account, incredibly offensive if it were true, also really weird. Like how would these demonstrators get to the tarmac? Why would you unload wounded people that close? I mean, it just, when you actually start to frame a mental picture of a big plane and men on stretchers and a line of MPs in ponchos coated in rotten eggs and an angry crowd behind them, it is impossible to reconcile that with the degree of professionalism that the military took in caring for its wounded. So they're very, very problematic details in some of these stories. Okay. So what were soldiers concerned about when they came home from Vietnam? I think there was an awareness that there was an anti-war movement and there was some hostility towards soldiers. Okay, there was an awareness of that. I think the principal concern that they had when they came home was this, which is the very human need to reconnect with friends and family, to kind of re-enter their lives, which had been, kind of interrupted in a dramatic way by the war. And this photo, incidentally, is from, I think, 1968 or 69, a soldier at Logan Airport in Boston, and the moment when his family saw him again. This was back in the day when people actually could go out on the tarmac at an airport, and so he literally walked off the stairs to the plane into the arms of his family. And, the mother's expression, I think, is just, captures that ache and that longing that a family would feel. And so that was the primary concern of veterans. They were also concerned about these issues. And this is what I'm going to turn to on Wednesday. They were concerned about how they were going to use their GI Bill benefits to move on to their lives and essentially try to make the Vietnam War, a good experience that put them further to their lifelong career and professional goals. For those that were injured, they were concerned with healing, with getting better. And the image is from a 1970 Life magazine expose of a paraplegic veteran who's been given a cigarette by a wheelchair-bound veteran. And the beds are literally piled, are next to piles of garbage. In fact, I cut the image, like there's other trash cans. I cut it to fit on the slide, but it's just, it drives home the message that a lot of these guys were warehoused in inadequate facilities where they were treated like garbage. And so that is a problem that veterans are very, very concerned about. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them are concerned with ending the war so that nobody else has to go through what they just went through. So we're going to talk about those activities in the 60s and 70s on Wednesday. So thank you very much. And if you have questions about anything, you can ask me after class or send me an email. And I'm working on the papers, and I will be emailing those back to you as I get them done. So, all right, thank you, guys.
Next week on Lectures in History, Professor Nathan McCall looks at the history of stereotypes of African Americans in the media. The class took place at Emory University in Atlanta. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in History are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcast or download them from iTunes.